The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 15th of October, 2020. On the podcast today, George McDonough, co-founder of KR1, discusses the recent sale of Polkadot tokens worth over $1 million, which represents only a small part of the company's Polkadot position. Also on the podcast, Ed Dawson, managing director of Prospects Energy, explains why they've sold the remaining assets to focus on their Spanish and Italian gas projects. Also, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers news from the following companies: Domino's Pizza Group, AO World, Hollywood Bowl, and Hammerson. Plus, as always, at the end of the podcast, I'll be highlighting two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists, top 10 versions of these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk. We can see lots for the content. There's an article there about Synergen raising 80 million. There's also something on Carillion, ahead of expectations there. Good update from them. And of course, don't forget, check out our COVID-19 index. Biggest riser there today. It's a bit of a down day across the board, but biggest riser is Novacyt, up 5.4% to 875. That's the king of the COVID testing stocks, earning so much money, unbelievable. And the biggest faller, of course, Synergen. It did raise a discount, 80 million, but nevertheless, 80 million at 175. I think the last time they raised money was 14 million at 35 pence. So you can see what an upgrade that was. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is George McDonough, co-founder of KR1. George, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And KR1 is the ticker. It's easy to remember, KR1. It doesn't get more simple than that. So, George, some good news out of late. Unbelievable. And we'll get into that in a bit. Before we do, for people never heard of KR1, can you explain what you're about, please?
Yeah, sure. So we're a blockchain and digital asset investment company. We give investors access to the crypto economy via a publicly listed share. So, we focus on Bitcoin and Ethereum and decentralized finance, or DeFi, as it's called. And we look to source deals right at the cutting edge of the technology as it's developing through time. So, you know, we look at staking, interchain protocols, privacy networks, as well as obviously maintaining a balance of the core assets. And so we were the first institutional investor in the space, really, starting back in 2016. Since then we've built up a great portfolio and a network that allows us to, you know, navigate the space successfully.
Yeah. And that's it. You have to navigate because there's so many sort of cryptocurrencies out there, and it's a bit like the Wild West. You have to know what you're doing. And looking at your last update on Polkadot, one of your investments, you did a portfolio update. It looks like you know exactly what you're doing because the returns there have been amazing. Largest investment to date, $1 million you put into it in 2017. So why did you put so much in? And just tell us how it's gone.
Yeah, it's been hugely significant for KR1. It was, as you say, our largest investment, and made some time ago. But we put it into what we felt at the time was one of the most interesting projects to sort of show itself. It's come back. It's come back very strongly onto the market. I think currently we're looking at about 15 to 16 times our money, which, you know, considering we put $1 million in, is hugely material for the company.
Yeah. Go on, George.
I was just gonna finish up there by saying the main reasons why we committed so much back then was, it was a couple of things. Firstly, baked into what Polkadot is this idea that it's a proof of stake network. And at the time, you know, we understood that Bitcoin already had its inefficiencies with how the proof of work system works behind Bitcoin, and you know, all the mining machines, you know, burning through electricity and so forth. And so we felt that there had to be a way by which the technology moved itself on. That plus the fact that staking, gaining a yield on your investment was potentially, you know, game changing for the company. So although back then it was just a theory, proof of stake, we started backing projects that had that element to them. And then I think lastly, a great way to look at something like Polkadot is, you know, you have what we call layer one protocol. So, you know, Bitcoin's a layer one, Ethereum's a layer one protocol. And then you have layer two, which is like scaling and privacy. And then layer three, which is the sort of application layer. Well, you could look at Polkadot as layer zero. It sits right at the bottom of that stack. And what it does is it allows interoperability between chains. So if you think of it a bit like a city, so a city that can only trade within itself is a blockchain. But as soon as you allow other cities to trade with other cities and kingdoms to trade with other kingdoms, well, that leads to prosperity. And so what Polkadot's doing is it sits underneath blockchains and allows them to trade with each other. So that's quite a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, John, just looking at this now, your company, KR1, is valued around 17 million market cap there. Now, you've taken the stake out, so you've taken, $1 million out just over that. Remaining position is valued at 15 million. Now, you've got lots of other investments and cash at current market prices. So how do you manage this now? You know, what's the plan going forward here?
Well, as you say, we've taken our investment out, and that will be put to work, you know, in the ecosystem as it evolves. You know, currently, of course, you know, we've got a lot of attention pointed towards the Polkadot ecosystem and the new projects that are building on that new ecosystem. But for the remaining, like I mentioned, it's really all about staking. We have put that a balance of tokens to work on the protocol, and we put out a staking update to the market about a month and a half ago, and that showed that we were taking in the region of about $200,000 a month from that staking holding. And that's, you know, when you combine that with our Cosmos holding, which is again a staking protocol and another, you know, hugely successful investment of ours, the company is making material income, which, as I'm sure everyone can understand, is, you know, hugely valuable to the company. That so that we can continue to make investments and cover company costs and various other items.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned there, but still going back, I mean, these companies that pay you basically a dividend like that, like, so staking, and so what is the kind of return you get for doing this? I mean, how does it work?
Well, it's quite a complex system.
Yeah.
But essentially, if you understand how Bitcoin works and how effectively what miners are doing is burning electricity,
yeah,
to prove that they have skin in the game and to basically keep them honest. Because if they're not honest, then they've got an electricity bill to pay at the end of the month, and they won't have the money to pay for it. This is a similar structure, but instead of buying electrical boxes that you plug in and burn electricity, instead what you're doing is you're locking away collateral that if the validators that are forming the blocks misbehave, you know, you can lose some of that collateral. So it's a very similar mechanism, but doesn't require the hardware. And so the fees that move around the Bitcoin ecosystem end up in the pockets of the miners. Well, in the same way that there are fees moving around these proof of stake networks, they end up in the pockets of the people who have staked their tokens. So what we're receiving is very similar to the rewards that the Bitcoin miners get.
Yeah. Okay. And just looking at that, you know, phenomenal returns. Like you say, 15 times, pretty much 16 times. Now, is that a one-off, or do you foresee sort of similar returns in the years ahead? And if so, you know, which area of digital assets do you envisage making these kind of investments in?
Well, it's a fascinating space, and you know, programmable money is in its very earliest stages of development. You know, we're close, you know, 11 years into this experiment, and there's almost no limit to how disruptive blockchain technology is. And so, you know, as this new financial landscape takes place, there is potential for projects to find great product market fit. And let's also not forget that the space is growing every day. So, I mean, just take for the example the fact that, you know, some of the world's largest companies are beginning to put Bitcoin on their balance sheets. The growth is clear to see. And so, KR1 invests on the cutting edge of this technology. So there's always the opportunity for us to find new projects that have taken the technology on one step further. And it takes some time for the market to catch up with that innovation. I mean, let's not forget at one point that Ethereum was just a theory on a piece of paper. And now, you know, alongside Bitcoin, it's being put on balance sheets too, right? They sort of go hand in hand with each other. And so that course of development that takes place over time, we're now looking at things like Polkadot and Cosmos doing their thing. Well, of course, they were just theory, 3 years ago. And, 3 years from now, it might be that companies have to have things like Polkadot on their balance sheet because of the 12% a year it's providing in yields. So the technology moves on, and gradually over time, our portfolio will come to reflect the size of the ecosystem as it grows. It's a hugely exciting space to work in, as you can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's very at the start of a new horizon there. Cool. Okay, George. Well, listen, as always, if someone likes the sound of the progress you're making but are not yet following the story, give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets, and they'll start receiving updates whenever you release them straight to the front screen of their phone. So three reasons right now, George.
I'd say that the main reason, of course, is that we provide early access to some of the best projects in the space. In terms of the portfolio capturing the movement of the space, that's one reason. I guess another reason would be because we're a listed stock, you can put us in your ISA if you're a UK resident, which is also hugely useful. And also because we're listed, there's a sense of transparency there in terms of what we buy and what we sell, and it should be clear to investors how the company is structured, and that isn't always the case in crypto.
yeah, absolutely, George. Thanks for that, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Ed Dawson, Managing Director of Prospects Energy. PXEN is the ticker there. Ed, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me on.
No worries. Bit of news out. Some cash in the bank, which is good. We'll dig into that. As always, though, Ed, if someone's listening to Prospects Energy, I've never heard of them. What do you do? Explain them. What do Prospects do, please?
We are quoted on AIM. We're an investment company focused on European gas and power projects. We've having announced the divestment of our Romanian project, focused on three projects. One in Italy, where we're expecting production on next year, first half. El Romeral is a big, hopefully a bypass gas field in the south of Spain, which is... I've got the wrong projects I'm talking about. Sorry. Can I start or cut this out? Or
Yeah. Just say, in fact, just say we're going to talk about our Romanian project, which we sold in a bit, and then just go to the next other two. Here we go. So I'll just add summary. Ed, give us, what are you all about? Please tell us what you're all about.
We are an AIM-listed investment company focused on European gas and power. Having divested our Romanian project, we're now focusing on our Italian production, which will hopefully come on stream first half of next year. And in Spain, we have two projects, the Tesorillo gas project, where there could be up to 830 BCF of resources in the ground. And we also have the El Romeral project, which is a gas-to-power station, that sits on a number of prospects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, we'll go into more details on those. But before we do that, like you say, the divestment of your Romanian asset, what's the deal here? What did you get for it and why did you do it?
Well, it was instigated by a strategic review of the portfolio at the start of the year. If you list and then rank all our prospects, we get to about 25 of them. And, you know, the technical team were asked to sort of rank them and assign them, you know, A, B or C. And with the El Romeral project coming on board at the beginning of the year, we've bought in to the list another 11 items. And generally speaking, they are all of higher grade than our project had in Romania. So it was clear that, you know, in the coming years, we would be focusing on those over what we had in Romania. Therefore, we considered exiting it. So today, there's production there. Not a huge amount, but, you know, it's been a nice steady earner for us. But we've agreed to sell the company for £215,000. And we have an £182,000, in the bank already from that deal. So, always helpful.
Yeah, absolutely helpful. And let's go on to say, first of all, then now your core projects. And it's always good, I suppose, to, like you say, list and prioritize projects, even tasks, you know, and then realize which is the most important, and then drop the bottom ones off. So let's go to Italy. So you say first production next year, H1 next year, and what are you hoping to produce from that? And financially, how rewarding is it going to be for you?
We are hoping, or the operator is guiding still, that it will come on production first half of next year. The kit there is going to be able to do 150,000 cubic meters of gas per day on a gross basis, which over a year to us will on an annual run rate, will put it somewhere between €1 million, €1.5 million, €2 million net to us. Well, slightly depending on gas price at the time and startup volumes, but considering our market cap, that's a big, jump in revenues.
Yeah, what is your market cap? But it's
2 million quid.
Two million. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. So that's significant there. And then, what about the onshore Spain gas and power project there?
So El Romeral has a power station there at the moment. It's an 8-megawatt power station that is effectively running at 20% capacity. Mm-hmm. The plan there in time is to go and drill up a number of the prospects there. There are 11 being identified on high-quality seismic. There's good AVO on them. To date, the success rate is very high. They're considered very low risk. 70% of the wells drilled in the area have been put on production. So, you know, we see that as a good, steady way of increasing production at El Romeral, you know, over a number of years. But again, you know, it's just a step up. If you look at historic prices of electricity, the power station, you know, we can look at it generating €4 million a year in revenue, which equates to, sort of 2 million after tax. So again, though we only have half of it, a good, cash flow generative business to sort of push the whole thing along.
Yeah. Absolutely. And what about the gas project there? Tesorillo, is that right?
Yeah. This was drilled in the 50s. Gas came to surface. It's right on the southern tip of Spain. We believe it's a bypass gas field. There could be up to 800 BCF there. One of the attractions is a lot of European gas comes from Algeria through the Maghreb pipeline. In fact, the Maghreb pipeline goes through this block. So, you know, in a success case, the capital cost for the project is going to be relatively small. So these projects are all in gas, so we're at the cleaner energy end of the energy space. Obviously, there's no oil here, there's no heavy oil. And we believe that gas in the next 20 years, you know, will remain a very key bit of the European energy matrix. It's going to be the transition fuel. You know, renewables and stuff like that are great, but it doesn't always rain, doesn't always blow wind, and or it's not always sunny. So, you know, there's a key space for gas here, and you know, we're very much plugged into that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, that's going to be one of your three reasons then, as always. If someone's listening right now, likes the sound of what you're doing there, the progress you will be making, but are not yet following the story, given those three reasons why they should hit that follow button and add Prospects Energy to their watch list, please.
Well, as you've highlighted, our market cap is £2 million. It's, you know, the balance sheet is sort of £6 million of assets. We are focused but diversified. And we've got a number of upcoming key milestones in terms of approvals that could lead to market re-rating.
Excellent stuff, Ed. It's good to chat to you as always, and hopefully you'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Thanks. Yeah, good. I'm busy. Goodness gracious, it's a busy day in the corporate results world. Thousand and one regulatory news statements. That's what it seemed like. Probably wasn't that many in reality, but there you go.
Yeah. And in fact, the market's not looking very good today. It's down about the FTSE itself is down about just shy of 2%. A bit of a seller's day or buyer's day. I said that on Twitter earlier. I said, you know, depending on your outlook here, if you scale into companies or you see a company, you know, low valuation, you think, well, you know, you've got to accept it's going to be a bumpy ride for the next sort of 6 months in a stock. But if you think there's value after that, and in fact, you know, a good bit of upside, then days like today can present opportunities, can't they? You know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, why are the markets down? Well, you know, as always, there's many reasons, but I guess people would observe there's obviously some quite important discussions ongoing regarding Brexit. You've got all of the backdrop with the pandemic, second waves, more restrictions and everything, which, you know, classically is not good for economic activity. And then, you know, generally the fact that financial prices around the world have had a good last 6 or so months. And yeah, these are the markets. I mean, I think anyone who's been active in the markets for anything more than a few months or a couple of years or something would say, you know, these things happen. And actually, the key is to work out what's your plan, what's your focus, and go from there. Don't be too spooked by this. I completely agree. You know, Buffett talks about how, you know, he views big sell-offs as opportunity. This is not a big sell-off. This is a bad single day in the market. You know, if you go back to 6-7 months ago, that was a material sell-off, and people had a choice, as always, as to what to do. But markets are always voting machines in the short term. They go up and down based on sentiment and flows and everything else, and it will always be thus, I'm afraid. And fortunately, over the long whole, it is driven by profits and cash flow and stuff that you can kind of fundamentally more get your head around. But, you know, welcome to the markets, I say.
Yeah, and I'd say generally, I mean, I think we're looking about, I mean, at the moment, I think we are heading towards, you know, a wall of fear. In fact, the fear is there at the moment. It's, you know, it's ramped up by the government. You know, the second wave coming could be bigger than the first. We haven't seen anything yet. You know, people are saying, well, hospital admissions haven't gone up. And saying, yes, it was only a couple of weeks away and deaths. So we are getting this uncertainty again ramping up. And generally, that's a good backdrop in which to buy. Because like you said, if you'd gone back to March and you'd bought in that, you know, when the fear was so high, people, you know, couldn't see. Basically, they're 10 yards, you know, more than 10 yards ahead of them, a bit scared to look beyond that, thinking the world's going to end. If you'd bought in that time, you'd be sort of laughing down to sit on a nice profit. So it's almost like the fear's there. And I think generally now, even if you look at, you know, sort of long-term estimates, even if you get to next summer, There'll be a sort of a vaccine. Some are saying we'll have vaccine news out by the end of this month on certain companies. Others say American companies towards the end of the year. But even that, I think it was Kate Bingham, head of the vaccine task force, saying by next July, pretty much, it'll be, you know, a vaccine will be circulated by then. So even if you look at the long stop, it took in six, eight months. But in that time, you will have periods where there'll be positives and negatives of sentiment in the market. And, you know, and like I said, so the best time to buy is on negative sentiment, isn't it, really, you know?
Absolutely. And yet, you know, reality is, it's all about belief in mitigation and ingenuity. You know, that remains the key, really, for investment at this moment in time. So you're never going to get a perfect backdrop. When you do get something akin to a perfect backdrop, i.e. economies roaring away, growing, people being employed and everything, that's already factored into share prices.
Yeah.
And the market always looks forward. So, you know, you need to, as always, take a balanced view. Number one, think about what your personal plan is. You know, you shouldn't be investing aggressively monies which you need tomorrow or next year or something. You know, if you're looking to invest your pension monies for utilization in a decade or 30 years time or something, brilliant. Take that longer term view and you know, construct your portfolio accordingly. So there's always ifs and buts, pushes and pulls in the market. That's what makes it interesting. It is an intriguing game of emotions and economics and everything else combined together. From my perspective, I'm actually, you know, am I excited about opportunities for 2021? I am. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I've actually, currently I'm standing at 10% cash. That actually is higher than it has been for the last few months.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was purely driven by the fact that certain stocks hit their target. And so, as always, you know, when a stock hits its target, you know, the target you've kind of constructed for it, you say, well, can it kick on further? And, of course, there are scenarios where it could. But then you say to yourself, well, hang on, you know, it's hit my target, you know, it's okay at the moment, but maybe there's some more compelling things out there. And I actually thought, as I raised some cash recently, that this earnings season that's upcoming, you know, around the world at the moment, it is going to throw up opportunities. And genuinely, I am excited about prospects of 2021. Some recovery in markets, some dislocated sentiment. That's interesting for a stock picker.
Yeah, absolutely. And just on your targets there, I assume you have specific targets for specific stocks, or do you have a generaliser 10, 20, 30%, 40%, whatever?
It's generally a specific target for a specific stock. Yeah. You know, of course, it's lovely to be able to say, right, you know, I'm going to make 25% on a stock and get out. And some people do that very successfully. But reality is, you've always got to adjust your targets and your thoughts for prevailing conditions or what you can see over the next little while. Because as we all know, some stocks, they don't stop at 25%, they go to, you know, 5,000% or whatever it might be, whilst others never get to 25%, and you have to make a hard decision whether to double or quits or exit at a loss or whatever. So it always has to be specific, in my opinion. But, you know, wrapped around a broader approach, which is appropriate for your risk profile in terms of what you're trying to do.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Well, do you know what? I genuinely, when I look at the company, one of my filters is, can a company, and I look at small cap stocks, of course, micro caps even, and I genuinely look at companies, and you can, you know, look at this. Does the company have a roadmap? And are they scalable to 10 times their valuation? And I look at that. And people always say, never, you know, never limit your upside, always limit your downside. To me, I genuinely, if you do enough the research, you know, and you do enough research, you should know you're close to a bottom, really, sometimes, because you've got a good, decent valuation at the moment, and then you look at the growth of that, and they've got cash and all that stuff. And so my downside is 100%, and my upside is like, 1,000%, hopefully. But obviously, I never get to 1,000% naturally. But I mean, I genuinely, you know, aim for, I don't like to limit upside. People say to me, what's your target? Well, I say, I don't really have one at the moment. I'm trying to make a valuation, you know, projection. But again, that's hard, because once you get momentum come into a stock, it can go way beyond that valuation. And if you just sell at your target, you know, area, then you could have lost a lot of upside, you know? And that's do you know what? It just makes it fascinating, I find stocks just fascinating, because the analysts can't price in momentum, especially in small stocks. When they get the the heat and the hype and the potential, and lots of people jump on board and understand the potential that could happen with the company, it can really take off way beyond what you thought it could go, you know? And I've seen big up days followed by big up days, and then all of a sudden you think it's going to come back by 10% or 20% or something, and then you have another big up day because people are just catching on, fear of missing out and all that stuff, and they're buying at the wrong price really, but that can go on for a lot longer than you realise, you know? Same with down days, same with sell-offs, you know? Same with sell-offs.
You know, you've got to reflect in you've got to shift and evolve your target prices as new information comes to light. My feeling is generally, though, and you're absolutely right, you make your big money in those compounders, be it quickly or slowly, which go up way beyond what you could have expected at day one of your investment. But the you know, it's a psychological question, and it is, how do you sort of keep yourself in a stock which is a big compounder, which is a 5-bagger or a 10-bagger or something? And I've found, you know, anybody hopefully comes across a few of those in their investing career. But what I found historically is, if you take out half your money when it doubles, then actually it liberates you psychologically. Yeah, yeah, and I've done that a few times. It says, look, at worst case, even if it goes to zero afterwards, I got my money back and I learned a lesson. But actually, you know, in reality, you're hopeful that, you know, it's going to do somewhat better or whatever else. And I found that's very liberating. And that's psychology and investment. You know, the people who can sit there and see something, an investment, a modest investment, let's say, compound up, you know, 100 times or something in some gargantuan winner and not touch it, I tip my hat to them, because I probably couldn't do it. Just psychologically, I'd be sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, what happens if, you know, that marginal news flow on the stock, it goes down a quarter or half? Your regret function is just huge. Yeah, but I don't have that if I take my money out if it doubles.
Yeah, you know, I saw a guy on, he made a good point on CNBC a while back about Amazon stock, and the drawdowns are massive, you know, in the last, I mean, not so much now, but you go back like 10 years and the drawdowns, and in a year, just the volatility in that stock. And he said, do you know what? Who's held Amazon stock from day one, pretty much, or first year of listing to now? He said, apart from Jeff Bezos and maybe his missus and his parents, nobody. He said, you know, it's been that sort of volatile. You would never go, because you'd never expected it to have dominated the way it has, you know? But but if you hung in there, of course, you'd have really reaped the benefits of that. But anyway, cool. Let's have a look at some stocks. What news is out today?
Domino's Pizza, probably got to start with, which is obviously a well-known name. We all use it, or many people have used it. I see their sales in their most recent period were 95% online, which, you know, is very on-trend and what you would expect in today's world. But actually, Domino's, the share when I last looked was down 8-9% on the day. And, you know, it's kind of, I guess, an indicative of one which is still performing. You know, you look at their comments today in terms of their system sales and everything else, and it still seems reasonable. They're still growing as a business. They're still tapping that trend of online consumption and convenience and everything else. It is sort of an alternative to home cooking that you can tap easily and still feel safe about it. So if you look at the what they just talked about, they talked about, I think, an 8% increase in like for likes, which is pretty damn good in the wider scheme of things. But the share is down, I think, because that was all sort of expected, and actually they didn't raise, despite seemingly some good trends in sales and online and everything else, they didn't actually raise at the bottom line their profit expectation. You know, that is still in line with expectations, and hence I think there's a bit of buy in the rumour, sell on the fact with this one. And hence why the shares are down today. I mean, ultimately, what they're saying is, if I kind of look at their profitability, mooted profitability level for the full year, and look at the share price or the market cap valuation, you're already paying 15 or times for Domino's, which seems about right. You know, that is not, you know, it's not gargantuan, but it's not tiny either in terms of a valuation. Ultimately, for a pizza business, you know, deep penetration, you know, deep pan pizzas, but deep penetration as well of the market, you know, it's a saturated market, etc. It feels about, you know, what you would be paying for it. And so I think, as I say, a bit of a sell on the fact today on that one.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? Wow, I just look at the chart there. What is that? Down 10%. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't get it right. Okay, cool. Big red. It's like the top end of one of his pizzas there. A lot of red there. Cool. Okay, what's next, Chris?
Contrast, Domino's is down a bit, as I say. It's all kind of factored in. AO World, which obviously those annoying TV ads amongst other things. But clearly,
let's go. I know, as soon as you said that, it got me.
It's probably why, you know, the share's been quite successful recently. It's on trend, clearly. Again, you know, the acceptance and encouragement of online purchasing and related. If you look at the shares, they've absolutely romped year to date. You know, from, I think, 50-odd p at the trough. I mean, when I last looked, it was in the mid to 200 pence area, which, you know, was obviously a gargantuan return. So well done to anyone who bought it anywhere near the bottom. But, you know, an interesting statement from them today. Yes, you know, you've got the very clear positives. You're talking about UK revenue up 54%. German revenue, German is their other main market, not as big as the UK, but growing as well, growing even faster. 80% revenue growth there. And it looks, you know, a very good half-year trading update. But once again, and this is my beef with AO World, you go back to historic statements, they've never really made proper money. It's all been EBITDA level at best. And even in today's trading update, you know, they gave a nice, you know, quite terse update on revenues and some trends and sort of nodded towards how brilliant they were. But again, nothing about the profit line. You know, they've got to tell us, you know, the share has romped on hope that they're actually going to be a profitable, sensible business that you can value on some kind of conventional measure. Tell us, you know, tell us in the statement. At least Domino's, yeah, the share's down, but at least they told us something about profit as well as sales. But, you know, AOL didn't. So shares romped, shares continuing to romp when I last looked today. But I'm sorry, not so good in terms of just clarity and openness on the regulatory news statement this morning.
Yeah, maybe for a reason. I mean, let's be honest. Excellent, that trading update we've done. That's the thing with trading updates. You don't get they can ramp it up a little bit. They can pick the metrics they want. You know, they're good, they're flattering metrics, and ignore the bad ones. And then hopefully that'll give them a bit of a runway for the share price to run up to the results, which they'll drop off at, you know, because they'll have to reveal warts and all, won't they? So, yeah, that's pretty good.
So what I'm saying is, you know, just interpret it carefully always. As I say, AOL shareholders, well done. If you've caught bought it in the last 6 months, you know, congrats. Great, great call. But, you know, I'm afraid I need a little bit more of a fundamental underpinning to understand that one.
Yeah, look at that. May the 4th be with you. You could have bought this for 60 pence, and now it's 260. That's a nice return.
There you go.
A couple of months. Yeah, cool. All right. Anything else, Chris?
Line Hollywood Bowl. It's actually a bit smaller of a company that I would normally talk about, but it struck me as an interesting statement here, going back down to what you can read from what they've talked about. Actually, at a certain level, quite a nice statement. You know, I've been to Hollywood Bowl. You know, see, they've clearly been impacted by the pandemic and related. But, you know, if you look at what they're saying today, yes, you know, revenues are still only 60-odd% of what they were, but they're still over the full year expecting a small increase in revenues on a like-for-like basis. They're still expecting to be mildly profitable. And, you know, they've got very low net debt in the wider scheme of things. So, actually, if I was a Hollywood Bowl shareholder, I would say, all right, guys, you actually not done too bad a job in the wider scheme of things. The share hasn't won a loss, didn't react at all to the statement. You know, it's kind of out for the count of it at the moment, narrowish range. You know, people are waiting developments, which maybe is sensible. But actually, in terms of the tone of the update, some of the granularity in it, it was actually helpful. You know, it was way more helpful than the AO World update, but no share price reaction. That's a much more interesting combination to me. I don't know whether the Hollywood Bowl is particularly cheap or not. I haven't done the work on it. But just my observation on the tone of the statement, the lack of a market reaction, yeah, worth a look, I would say.
Yeah, and definitely, because I have an interest in another sort of leisure company, and I'm just looking at, I looked at this just to see what, you know, what it's like. And I assumed it was going to be a basket case, but they've come out with, in capitals, encouraging customer demand following reopening. And I think that's going to be the case, actually. I mean, if they've got, like, enough, like I said, a strong balance sheet, and they can see them through this, and they know the demand's there, and they've been doing quite well beforehand, then it's going to be okay afterwards. And like I said, I mean, you know, I said 6 months, it's going to get slowly. I know we're in the midst of this fear, you know, lockdowns and all that now, but I think it's going to slowly get better over the next 6 months. We'll start reopening, hopefully, with the news on vaccines and all that stuff. But I think you've got a good balance sheet and you were sort of a market leader like this, then there's no reason to think why people won't come back, is there really?
Yeah, I think that's right. And sustainability is the key because we all know that unfortunately, there's going to be some dark days. And yes, we all know that traditionally at the start of the year, post-Christmas, they are the toughest trading months, January, February. People are short of cash. And I guess it's going to be that geared up this, you know, in early 2021, unfortunately, because of the backdrop for everything we see. The market does know that as well. But, you know, for companies at a practicality basis, if you've got low net debt, that really helps, or cash in the balance sheet or something like that. I have to say, Hollywood Bowl strikes me as a survivor. And on that basis, you can start thinking about how you would possibly value it and think about it as a business. And they've got some opportunity, one assumes as well, in some of their units, because I guess they lease them. They probably don't own them freehold, to cut some great deals themselves. So, you know, it cuts both ways. You know, the pandemic, as I say, it's this sort of dual-backed opportunity and threat that we talked about with the general markets. It's the same in the business environment out there too. But Hollywood Bowl, yeah, you know, tip of the hat to them. I thought actually the stem today was quite good.
Yeah, another one with there. Well, in fact, they used to have that catchy advert and they got rid of it. I thought, don't do that. Hollywood Bowl. Then a long, deep. And I said, because I used to work at a radio station and we used to have a Hollywood Bowl next to us. They used to advertise on the station as well. And it literally was so catchy, it was so annoying. But that it stuck in people's heads and they changed it. I thought, what are you doing that for? That's the what you want to achieve is one annoying, you know, earwig, what they call it, and just stays in your head all day. That's what you want, you know, to achieve that level of consciousness amongst people. But and they've changed it. I thought, oh, that's silly for them to do that. But anyway. Yeah, exactly. And but it's like trying to write a number one hit single. Once you get there, you know, you don't just stop selling the single. You still make it available. Anyway, cool, Chris. Anything else there?
Well, Hammerson, I know we've talked about commercial Hammerson. Property and just check out the statement today. I mean, they talk about the amount of the rent that they were due that they've collected. Get this for a progression. So currently, of their quarter one rent, i.e. first 3 months of the year, unsurprisingly, they've got 97% of that. You know, they obviously collect the rent at the start of the period, so that's what they would have collected in the either late December, early January. So, yeah, you know, you'd expect that. 97%, pretty normal. Quarter two, 59%. Spot the pandemic impact. Quarter three, also 59%. Ain't getting better. And quarter four to date, so they would have collected this late September, early October, 41%. Ooh. It's not getting better, is it? And you know, the trouble is they have done the emergency money raising and they just about sort of got it away, but it's canned the share price completely, you know, which is a fraction of what it was from a year ago, let alone 3 or 5 years ago. Just strikes me, you know, why do you bother? Yes, I know it's trading at a big discount to book and whatever else, but there's a reason for that when you've got those sorts of collection rates. So yeah. I would still be avoiding the space.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, exactly. It's and again, it's a play on COVID, isn't it? You know, when we see when we get some news on the vaccine and it starts to circulate, once we get news, then you can count another 3, 4, 5 months. I mean, they're stockpiling already, a bit like AstraZeneca and all that. But it'll take another 3, 4, 5 months to get it circulated to the vulnerable groups. And then it's another sort of 3 months again, maybe to a wider population. So it's going to be another 6, 7, 8 months before we get anything. And like I said, people are not just going to rush back to the shops as soon as news on a COVID, on a vaccine is announced. So it'll take a while, won't it? And I'm just looking at their portfolio here. They've got obviously Brent Cross is their big one, isn't it? And then they've got Bullring in Birmingham, Cabot Circus in Bristol. You got one in Merthyr Tydfil, which is not far from my hometown, Croydon. Yeah, so, Bicester. Oh, wow. Yeah, no, it's exactly. You can afford to do your research on this one and sit back for a long time, I think. And, you know.
That's right. And the thing is that they're facing a structural shift as well. It's not just COVID, is it? Clearly, that's highly impacting their business tactically. But structurally, we're seeing a shift towards online purchasing and alternative streams, which is where you think about the names we've talked about today. You know, yes, I can understand why AOL shares may have romped. They've still got to make money. You know, that's still the key and insights on that. Domino's are already predominantly online business. And I think something like a Hollywood Bowl is an experience thing. You know, that's got a much more potential to be all right despite our online obsession on stuff because it's actually going out and doing something. But yeah, going to the, you know, the big structure of financing and leasing out units within a big shopping centre or commercial property backdrop, you know, that's much tougher. You know, you've got a lot more fixed costs there and other things you've got to take care of, maintenance and related, just to keep a show on the road. So, yeah, good luck to them. I'm afraid they're going to need to keep on collecting more rent, because otherwise it just ain't going to work.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Cheers for that, Chris, and we'll speak to you next week.
Sunday.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Orosu Mining, OMI, up 22%. At four, Alien Metals, up 18.8% to 1.485. At three, Synergen, down 11.95% to 1.99. At two, Erasure Mining, 31 pence, down 1.6. And at one, it's Ferroalloy Resources, FAR is the ticker there. It is down 5% to 9.125. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Mosman Oil and Gas. Falcon 1 log results indicate hydrocarbons. At four, EasyJet, director shareholding. At three, pardon me, Think Smart Limited, capital return and dividend notice AGM. At two, Equals Group, acquisition and further B2B growth. And at one, it's Iconic Labs, update on financing terms. Check those lists out at voxmarkets.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.